Good morning and welcome to our podcast. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing here at Sintins, joined again today by my colleague Jessica Gower, who is a Senior Associate in the Neurotrauma team here at Sintins. And our podcast today is episode 6 in our Wider Issues in Catastrophic Injury podcast series. Today, Jessica's going to be speaking to Louise Masters, who is a partner and head of the family team here at Sintins. And this episode is episode 2 of the Family Law Implications After Serious Injury podcast. Episode 1 is available on the website to check out if you wanted to do that in chronological order. So without any further ado, enough from me, straight over to Jessica. Jessica, good morning and over to you.
Thank you, Dave. David, and thank you, Louise, for joining me again today. Obviously, this is the second podcast that we've recorded together. And in our first one, in the last episode, we spoke about the changes in dynamic of relationship and how families can be impacted after a life change and injury. But what we didn't explore in that podcast was specifically how children might be impacted. And obviously that could be that whether it be the child that's sustained a life change and injury or whether a parent has sustained a life change and injury. So I thought we'd get together today and we'd just explore some of the issues around those two topics. But I wonder if it might be helpful for anybody who hasn't listened to our previous podcast to just talk a little bit about your role and the work that you do, just to kind of set the scene a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a partner in the family department here at Sintins, and we do all types of family law issues, including divorce and resolving the money on divorce and children matters. But we do have a strong link with our personal injury department and the Court of Protection team because of the crossover between family law and those areas, which is why this podcast has come about. So as you say, we're going to talk today about children and how they are affected if, for example, one of their parents has had a life-changing injury or they have. And obviously two completely distinct areas, but very, very important all the same.
Very challenging. And obviously, you know, all families are different, all relationships are different. And I guess your role, you know, you've never seen two situations the same, and it's difficult to consider each individual circumstances and what those needs are. So shall we start with when there's an injured parent? Is that a good place for us to start?
I think it is, because the first thing that I'll explain is that all parents should have parental responsibility for their children. So parental responsibility is a legal term which confers on the parent all rights, duties, obligations and things like that for their child. The mother obtains this when they have the baby, and the father obtains it if they are married to the mother at the time of the birth or their name is on the birth certificate. But if you're an unmarried father and your name isn't on the birth certificate, you won't have parental responsibility. And it's a very, very important concept, because if, say, for example, the child was out with dad and something happened, they had an injury or some important decision needed to be made and dad didn't have PR, they can't make the decisions about the child, only the mam can, or a medical professional or something like that. So it's firstly important to know what it is, who has it, and if you don't have it as an unmarried father whose name's not on the birth certificate, you can obtain it by an order of the court or by agreement with the mother. So most people, Jess, do have parental responsibility because they will fall into either the mother category or the father who's married or name on the birth certificate. So generally most people have PR, and when you have that together, both parents, you have to make decisions jointly about the child. However, one person can use their PR over and above the other person if the other person, for example, doesn't have capacity, which may come as part of their life change and injury. Or another factor which is relevant here, and we've seen it often, is if that parent is putting the child at risk. Now, you will know as well as I do, when you have a life changing injury, sometimes it can change your behaviour, your demeanour. And in those circumstances, we've seen, through no fault of that parent, they're putting the child at risk in one way or another. And therefore, the other parent who hasn't been directly affected by the incident, they would have to use their parental responsibility over the other parent who is already dealing with the injury or trauma or whatever it might be. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I mean, the only thing that occurred to me as you were speaking, Louise, was how does that differ if you have, say, same-sex couples, for example, or you have a family who have adopted? How does PR work then? Is that still the same or...?
It has to be acquired by the non-biological parent, but it would, yeah, you can still get it in the same ways. And so when I'm talking about mother and father, it could be mother and mother, it could be father and father, it could be surrogate parents who obtain a parental order and therefore acquire the PR. So this covers all spectrums of families. It's not just the traditional mother and father.
Okay. And I guess if somebody doesn't know whether they have it, how's the easiest way to find that out? I guess by looking at birth certificate, perhaps?
Yeah, that's right. And then come and see us. I mean, we can quite easily explain whether you've got it and how to get it. And as I say, it is really, really important to have. So where it is impacting your cases, Jess, is where you have an injured parent and they are not able to make those important decisions about the children. And we haven't got to forget that amongst all of this, they've had the life-changing injury. They've got loads of new professionals involved with their life and their relationship with their children probably is never going to be the same again. And it's about how we best manage that as part of this process. You'll recall from the previous podcast, we talked about formulating your claim to include family law legal costs. And as part of that, Jess, we need to be thinking about, number one, family therapy. I'm sure we mentioned this the last time.
Yeah, we did.
And perhaps other costs like mediation costs or counselling or something like that, just to help the family navigate their previous relationship to the one that they've got now and how the children come into that. Another cost, which if it appears that the parent who's suffered an injury is going to be a risk to the children in the long term and or perhaps doesn't have capacity to look after them, you might need to think about adding costs into your claim associated with a supervisor. So there are professional supervisors out there who can make themselves available once a week, twice a week, however many you need, but they need to be paid. And if you're not incorporating those into your claim, it's going to have to come out of your client's pot somewhere else.
Of course it is. And how does that work practically speaking then? So if we go back to the scenario where we've got two parents who have both got PR, and then you have one parent who has a life-changing injury and they find themselves in a position where either physically, you know, caring for children is difficult, or actually they pose an active risk because of their behaviour or their restrictions. How do you go about demonstrating that and approaching that? Like how, from a kind of your position, your perspective, how would you approach that as a professional?
So we act really collaboratively, because when you have children together, you want to have the best relationship you can after the separation or the injury or whatever. So we would encourage, you know, parties to get together and discuss these things. But if there's been a breakdown of the relationship between the parents, it's probably necessary to make an application to the court sooner rather than later, because in that forum, we can then get reports about what ability this parent has to look after their children. And if they don't have capacity or the physical ability to do that, what needs to be put in place to allow the contact to take place. Now, in that forum, we can then feed that back into your case for the costs. So we could have a report in the family law case saying, for contact to be exercised safely in this way, it's going to cost X amount for however many years, and that would feed back into your case.
And in terms of the assessments and what's taken into account, how is that approached? Is that approached on the basis of what's best for the children, or are other needs factored into that? Like, what's the court's general approach when they're considering applications like that? What things do they take into account?
The children's welfare is paramount. So, you know, we've had some tricky cases in the past where, unfortunately, because of the, for example, a brain injury, that parent is so unsafe that they really want to see their children, but the court has decided it's just not safe or appropriate or in the best interests of the children to have contact with that parent. Now, that's quite rare. The court will strive to do everything possible to allow children to have relationships with both parents, because that can only be right, can't it? Your identity and all the rest of it comes from your parents. But if it's not in their best interest because it's perhaps not safe, then there are other things. So obviously, most parents will want direct contact. So that's them having seen their children. And actually, we call it the arrangements for the children rather than contact, because it just means that they're spending different amounts of time with both parents. So those arrangements, you would like it to be face to face, you'd like it to be regular. If that can't happen, we need to be looking at what other arrangements. Does it need to be less often? Is it too unsafe for it to be face to face, and do we just do it on video? If the parent is saying inappropriate things, that might be too much for the children, and therefore we strip it back again to what's called indirect contact. So you would be sending letters or cards or gifts or things like that. So the arrangements can take place in lots of different ways, and it really is family specific.
And what happens if you, I'm sort of thinking out loud here, for some of my clients, they perhaps lack, if they have got a severe brain injury, for example, they might lack the insight or the awareness in terms of the behaviour that they're displaying.
Yeah.
And they might also have difficulties with memory, for example, or remembering dates, times, appointments for things, or parameters for those arrangements. You know, they might forget. Does the court take that into account when they're looking at what arrangements to implement and how an injured party can be supported in meeting those arrangements? Or is that something that would be considered outside of the family proceedings?
Again, it's about what's best for the child, but in these type of cases, obviously you've got to look to the parents as well. And this is why I'm saying, usually we say court is a last resort, but actually in these type of cases where there's been an injury or a catastrophic life-changing event, my view is you should go to court as soon as possible, because it can be regulated and formulated in that process, which then feeds into yours. So if, for example, we needed the care team to assist with putting dates in, getting the parent to contact, and that was going to cost extra money, that then feeds back into your claim. Absolutely. So I think it really needs to be done early on so that we can understand what needs to happen for it to be safe and work well. Of course, we don't want the children to be let down just for the fact that, for example, dad couldn't remember that he had to go there that day. It all costs money if you're having extra people support that. So that needs to be fed back into your claim.
I think there's a perception, isn't there, that when you involve a solicitor, or especially in family proceedings, for example, or you involve the court, that it's this real adversarial process and that everything's very contested and it's all very contentious and just not a nice environment. And so often there's this reluctance for, you know, for families to kind of go down that route because they don't want to be drawn into, I think the analogy you used in the last podcast was kind of putting on the boxing gloves and, you know, going down that route.
But I don't think it's the case in these type of situations. I think you need to get it in at court, not through animosity or to be taken as a hostile step. It's just a very good arena to have things properly planned out, paid for and formulated to move forward.
And does that differ then if we're looking at a child that's injured? Because obviously that's a very different scenario, isn't it, when you've got an adult that's, you know, a parent that's injured and you're looking at their capability to care for a child or their behaviour around a child. But it's a very different kind of consideration where you've got a child that's the injured party. And obviously there's arguably different things to consider from a family perspective as that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've dealt with lots of scenarios. So, for example, child has been injured at birth, and so the parents are still together and they deal with this trauma together. And in those circumstances, we've had parents who have stayed together and, you know, it isn't an issue seeing the child. They all live together in the child's house, which I'll come to separately later on. But then we've had situations where they've separated after the injury at birth. we've had situations where the parties have been in a relationship and the child's been injured later on in life. And again, they've either stayed together or separated. But the same thing applies with the PR. You don't lose your parental responsibility. If you do separate from your partner, husband, wife, whatever, you try to work together to use that PR for the best interests of your child. And it will just depend, you know, when the injury occurs, are they going to stay together or not? And if they can't agree the arrangements for the child, again, an application to the court could be made. But before that, the child needs to see both parents. In these scenarios, we're not saying either of the parents are a risk to the child. So what you could consider in those type of situations is things like mediation, where they go along and they try to agree the arrangements between themselves. So that's that. Does that cover what you were asking about?
It does. And I think, you know, some of the difficulties, after a child's had a life-changing injury, you know, it tears families apart. And often there'll be a disagreement between, you know, mum and dad or dad and dad or, you know, various people about what's in the child's best interests. And it might be that the two of them are not in agreement about, you know, even things like the type of care that they have or the type of equipment that they've got or where they're living or how funds are spent on. And, you know, all of those types of things can be quite challenging.
On that, again, and I really feel like a broken record on this, but in the child's claim, you should include costs for mediation if it looks as though the parents are going to separate, and if they're going to be together, family counselling, because it's because of the accident they're having these issues, or the injury they're having these issues, so they should be allowed to have those costs from the child's claim to help them navigate their new life. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, we've had issues before where the child lives in one house with one parent and the parents have separated either because of the trauma of what's going on or whatever. There's an argument here. If they're going to share the care of the child, how's that going to work practically? Because if you've got a child with very special needs who needs an adapted home, how can you just have one home when you've got two parents living separately? So I've had loads of discussions with people about this. I've never tested it out myself, but a colleague of ours, Alistair, he had a scenario where there was separated parents and one injured child, and they managed to claim for two adapted homes. Now, my view on that is, it's a struggle because obviously they don't want to pay out for two adapted homes. But the best way, in my view, to have the greatest argument and put as much weight as you can into this is if you go to court, again, not a hostile step, but you get an order saying that this child lives with both parents and at these times of the week. Because if you've got that order and you can say, well, look, this child needs two adapted homes because it lives with that parent on those days and that parent on those, I'm not really sure how that can be refused. Does that make sense?
It does. And I guess it depends on the age of the child as well, really, as to how successful that argument would be. I mean, if you've got a very young child and obviously they've got, you know, a long time before they kind of reach majority, then I think it's much easier to make out that argument. Where if you've got perhaps an older child who is, you know, late teens, you know, that might be a slightly more tricky argument to raise, subject to other issues that are in, you know, at hand, you know, what their intentions are in terms of education and employment and, you know, whether they intend to keep living with one or the other parent or they would like to move out. And then I suppose you're in that territory, do they need their own home at that point? But obviously that's an entirely separate avenue. And I guess the key to all of these issues, that, you know, we've spoken about this and probably said this, I think, in every single episode of this podcast series, is that, you know, no two people, no two cases are the same, and that you really do just have to consider each individual circumstances. And where in the example that you just gave about Alistair being successful in being able to secure adaptations for two homes because the child was splitting their week, you know, you might not necessarily have that successful argument in another case because of that separate set of circumstances. So, you know, all
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. On the property thing, this is where it gets really meaty when you have an injured child. So if the child is going to get a damages award, it's likely that a property will be purchased for the child, held on trust by deputy, yeah. Something like that. And recently we've had scenarios where a light bulb goes off and you say, well, hang on a second, these parents are living in this child's property. It's not theirs. They mm-hmm. shouldn't get an interest in it. They should be paying their way. And that hasn't happened historically as a matter of course, in my experience. So what we're tending to do now, and actually I think it should be happening on every case where the injured party, whether it's child or an adult, lives with someone else. So the injured child could live with their parents, or they could live with their siblings, or an injured party could live with a partner or a friend or a work colleague or whatever. What you need to have in place is a cohabitation agreement regulating the terms upon which they live together. And the reason for that is because if you've got one person who owns a property and other people are living in it, if that relationship breaks down, we've seen time and time again arguments and tens of thousands of pounds spent in legal costs on, you know, does the other person have an interest in this property or not? And we had one scenario where the child reached majority and didn't want the parents living in their property anymore, and the parents were refusing to move out. And things like that would be avoided if you had a cohabitation agreement in place. They can also include things like who's paying for what, if there are repairs required, who's going to pay that decoration, who pays the electricity bill. It can go as into as much detail as you needed to, but as a bog standard, it should say that the house belongs to X and Y and Z have no interest in it and won't gain an interest by living here or paying the electricity bill and things like that. And again, Jess, these cohabitation agreements, two things about them. We do them in a collaborative way. So I am routinely instructed by a child's deputy, and we will find another collaborative lawyer to represent the parents, and we all sit together and work through this document together because it protects both parties. So that's the way we like to do it. And actually, we've had some really great experiences where there's been, you know, a couple of issues between deputy and parents, which can happen given the nature of their own relationships. And we managed to get through any issues in this forum together. So it works really well. And the second thing I was going to mention was that if you've got an injured baby, for example, who is able to get a damages award and purchase a house when they're 3 years old, that child will, at that point, need a cohabitation agreement with their parents, definitely. And then if they've got siblings and the siblings grow up, they're going to need one with the siblings when they reach 18. So there's another cohabitation agreement. Now, if this child grows up and has capacity to live on their own or whatever, move a friend in or get a partner, all of these new people need a cohabitation agreement with this person. So I anticipate for a baby, you could be looking at something like 5 to 10 cohabitation agreements. They cost a lot of money. We quote about £5,000 plus VAT for us to prepare the document, and your client is generally paying for the other party's costs as well. If you times that up by how many cohabs you might need, it's astronomical. And again, those costs should go in the claim.
Because it's through no fault of their own that that's required. And obviously it's to protect their position. And I think we spoke about these previously, in that they can also be used if you've perhaps got an injured adult or an injured party who perhaps has a new partner, or right, that is living with them, or that moves in, or that they meet before that home's purchased. Or if you've perhaps got a couple who have lived together previously, but then, you know, as part of the case damages and the settlement damages, that, you know, property is included within that, that you can explore doing those in those scenarios as well, because they're quite broad. I think we spoke about this in the last podcast, didn't we, that actually they can be used for a whole range of scenarios, and they're really helpful in that sense. It's really difficult, isn't it, because, you know, relationships are changing, dynamics are continuously changing to what they were, you know, 50 years ago, and quite often you know, you see couples separating more commonly than staying together. And so it's natural that actually this process should be something that's taken into account, both when you've got an injured parent and also when you've got an injured child. Yeah. I guess the difficulty is knowing how much to factor in. And again, that's something that you're just going to have to consider on the basis of each individual's circumstances and age and dynamics. And
what we do routinely for your department is provide letters which you can incorporate in the claim, setting out, because of the injury, these are the likely family law legal costs which could happen in this person's life. But as you say, every scenario is different. So, you know, you need the facts of the case. You need to think about what is likely to happen. But it's really important that where we can protect the damages, we can't always do it, because if they get married, you know, we talked about this in the last one, they can be taken into account. But in this children podcast, these are things that you have to take into account, because we've got the rest of their life to live, and we need, where possible, to protect those damages.
So what's the process, Louise? I'm thinking of examples that anybody listening might be able to relate to. If you perhaps got separated parents and they're considering what school might be best for that child to go to, particularly if they've got additional needs as a result of their injury, and you've got, you know, perhaps one parent that's staying one place and another parent that's staying another. How would you have that reviewed? Let's, for argument's sake, that both of them have got PR. Is that the same process that you would need effectively to go to court and let a judge decide?
No, because there are steps beforehand. So technically, the school shouldn't really take an admission just off one parent. You've got to have both parents' consent. So if they're on loggerheads on the school or the care package or medical treatment or any important decisions like that, first of all, try and chat about it. If you can't resolve it in that way, the next step would be mediation. And a mediator is trained to facilitate the discussions between the parents, help them understand each other and what's out there and what could be best for the child. They don't give advice, but it is a really, really useful process, because if you're arguing about school, next week it might be arguing about medical. You can't be going off to court all the time. Courts don't want these cases in front of them, because it isn't actually a judge's role to be making these day-to-day decisions, even though they're important. They will do if every other avenue has been exhausted, because they have to, but they don't want to be. So there are other methods which you can try beforehand, engaging solicitors to work in a collaborative way. And what we do in that setting is we would all get together. So the four of us, two lawyers, both parents would get together, and we would talk about the options and what we think is best, and what we think if it went to court, what a judge would do. And so there's loads of different options before you get to court, and it's worth trying them, because, you know, you've got a co-parent for however many years, and if you try the alternative options, this should help with that communication.
Yeah, I think the only kind of other common scenario that I tend to see quite a lot is going back to where you have an injured parent and there is some frustration from that parent if they're being prevented from seeing their children, because either there's a perception that they're a risk or they're not safe, and that person doesn't agree with that. And I'm guessing from what you've said that process is exactly the same, that actually there is a discussion between the parties first, that there's potentially mediation, and that then if actually that's not successful, that it's only then that you go down that, you know, that process of bringing it to the court.
That's right. So mediation at the moment is a voluntary process, but I would encourage it because it can be really useful, especially in children cases. But there is a consultation going through at the moment to perhaps make it a compulsory process. That will take a while, but I suppose it's a tricky one, because the essence of mediation is you want to go along, you want to try and resolve it. If you're being forced into that, you know, I think people will go along kicking and screaming and put no effort in. So watch this space. But it is worth trying mediation, because as parents, you have to communicate, even if you don't like the other one. when you go to court, yes, the judge might impose a decision upon you, but you might not like that decision. You tell the judge what you want, the other person says what they want, and the judge can do something different. So you kind of, it's out of your hands by that point. So it is worth trying other methods first and working in a collaborative way if you can.
And when you say mediation, for anybody listening, is that a process of, you know, either party having their own representative and the kind of both of you getting around a table and having a discussion? Or are we talking about a situation where we've got an independent person who is kind of adjudicating between the two and mediating that process and having a conversation with both parties?
Yeah, so the mediator would do that. You generally just have one mediator. And you can bring other people into the mediation, you know. So, for example, you could bring the case manager in. You could bring, if the claim was underway and there was disputes, you could bring the lawyer from the claim. Things like that. You can bring third parties in. And the collaborative practice is where you have two collaboratively trained lawyers who know all about the law, and you would sit together with both clients and give legal advice along the way. That works really well because, you know, as lawyers, we're there for our client, but in this forum of four, and again, you can bring other people into it. Sometimes I have supported the other client because I've thought mine wasn't being reasonable, and vice versa, the other lawyer will support my client, and it works really well, especially in these cases where you have an injured child, because both of them, well, the whole family's been through a trauma and we're just trying to help them figure it out.
Sometimes emotions are just so high as well. Yeah. And that, you know, the stress is that high that it's really difficult for, you know, for people to detach or to think in a, you know, really kind of pragmatic, sensible way. Sometimes the, you know, all they can feel and experience is that really emotive response, and it does often take, you know, having a third party there just to balance that out a little bit.
That's right.
Especially if there's that, you know, long-standing relationship between the parties, especially if there's a long-term separation and they don't get on particularly well, that can be quite difficult scenario to navigate already. Mm-hmm. Even without, you know, a trauma or an injury, that then becomes an even trickier situation to navigate. So I can see that actually in having a process that is involving everybody and not kind of pitting people against one another almost, and that scenario about boxing gloves, that actually you probably have a much, you know, much more positive outcome all round. One that's likely to last longer as well.
That's absolutely right, Jess. Can I ask, just out of interest, how many clients of yours or their families or all together go off for kind of counselling and support in that way? Because I know they have so much else going on in the early stages, and you know, sometimes for years after the incident or accident or injury. So how many do you think take up those services?
I think it's really difficult because there are a lot more who should than perhaps do. And, you know, the reasons for that can be, you know, multiple. Sometimes people don't have an awareness that that's needed. I think there's still a big stigma actually around talking to therapists and getting support and acknowledging that there's a problem. What I often see from injured parties is this stoic, put on a brave face, everything's okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to put on anybody else. And
but then do you get that from the families as well?
I was just about to say that. One of the real difficulties is navigating guilt. I often have, you know, husbands or wives or, you know, daughters, sons who say, I really don't want to say how I'm feeling or how I'm impacted because I'm not the one who's had this life-changing injury.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I shouldn't feel this way. And, you know, my dad or my husband or my partner's had it so much worse, and I feel awful complaining about anything compared to how they're feeling and what they're going through. And so what you can find is that it takes a little bit of time before people are upfront and honest about exactly how they're feeling.
Yeah.
Before you can kind of suggest, you know, those processes and that help to them. And then the type of response you get, I think, again, will depend on awareness, background, dynamics of that relationship, because there's also, it's such an incredibly private time. You know, there's lots of change, and you've not only got your injured party that has to come to terms with how they've been impacted and how they feel about it and the changes that they're going through, but you've also got the relationships around them and the people around them that have got to come to terms with that as well. And, you know, you might find that you've got fiercely protective and private families that if one of them is honest with you and says actually they're really struggling and they would benefit from additional support or counselling, that's almost in a bit of a breach of trust, that shouldn't have been said to you because that wasn't a discussion or an agreement between. So it depends, really. I think absolutely every client that I act for and every family that I act for would undoubtedly benefit from having the offer of it being available and having the option there. Whether they accept that is down to personal choice and dynamics. Whether it's available is down to funding and often down to difficulties with, you know, with insurers and liability and the case generally. But I would love to see a scenario where I could offer that to every single client and every family that I have, because I think the value in having that available and having the option to engage in that and to talk through how you're feeling is really valuable.
Is
a benefit to everybody, because, you know, it gives that validation and that transparency, and it's just an open and honest way of moving forwards. You know,
we find that in with our clients, that because there's so much going on, they just don't have the mental energy or space to engage in counselling. But generally, the people who do it earlier on can deal with the process better,
mm-hmm.
because they're supported and they have the right tools to do so. But as you say, it's so tricky because there's so many different dynamics associated with that type of support. And but it's worth mentioning, I think, in every case, because the types of clients we deal with are suffering so much and they could perhaps benefit from it.
I think there's just a massive stigma generally around, or a lack of awareness generally around, you know, disability and life change and injury and just the extent of the impact. And also I think there's this perception that if you have if you have a solicitor appointed in any aspect, that, you know, just it has a certain perception to it that, you know, hopefully through doing this podcast series and through talking openly about these topics, that people will see that actually
it's okay.
Having counselling is okay, and actually it's it's beneficial. It should be commonplace, and that, you know, you and I who do this and see these things every single day from a professional perspective think that it's beneficial and certainly don't see it as a negative thing.
Yes.
So hopefully, you know, through doing that and through talking in the way that we are, you know, there is more awareness and things are a little bit less daunting. I think the more you speak about things and the more people are aware of options available to them and, you know,
what can happen,
what to expect and what can happen, the less scary it seems and the less kind of out of reach. I think for a lot of people, they don't understand what counselling entails. You know, what does that mean? Am I going to be in a room with people who are judging me, or, you know, what's going to be written down about me? How's that going to be perceived? And can I be really open about how I'm feeling, or am I going to be judged for that? And I think there's all of that. And how are other people going to feel about that? It's a lot to kind of contend with. But yeah, I would like to see it. Every time.
if we could finish off on this note about counselling, I had lots of experience of parents accessing counselling, and by all professionals, the court, CAFCA, social workers, it's thoroughly commended, because they're saying, look, acknowledge that you need help and support and you've gone off and done it, and it's absolutely at the top of everyone's agenda. So it ties in nicely with this theme. You know, if you're struggling and you want to see children, or the arrangements are a bit sketchy, and get some support.
Definitely. I mean, it's an empowering process, isn't it, that gives validation to somebody's voice and how they're feeling. And, you know, there are lots of different personalities to contend with. Everybody feels differently, and there's no right or wrong way for, you know, you to perceive something or the way that you feel. So I think, you know, you're absolutely right. It should always be seen as a positive thing. And hopefully, you know, some of the discussion that we've had today will help change some of that for you. It's been a pleasure, obviously, speaking to you about, you know, childcare issues in this podcast. Is there anything that you think we haven't covered or that you want to make, you know, add as a final comment?
No, not at all. I think we've covered both of the aspects well. But of course, if anyone has any questions, they can get in touch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As always, you know, we welcome any suggestions or any questions from anybody. If there's anything that we've raised and that is, you know, has perhaps raised a separate question, then we would love to hear it. So
thank you very much.
Thanks both. Enjoyed listening to that one. As always, very quickly for me, as I say at the end of each of these podcasts, we continue to work hard to produce, release and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And that includes all episodes of our Wider Issues and Catastrophic Injury podcast series. If you haven't had enough from us by that point, you can also follow the team on Twitter at SintonsPI and at SintonsNeuro. In terms of contact details, if you'd like to discuss anything our speakers have raised today further, please don't hesitate to get in touch with either of them or both of them by telephone 0191 226 7878 and via email jessica.gower@sintons.co.uk and louise.masters@sintons.co.uk. That's it for us for episode 6. Thank you once again for tuning in, sending in your questions. We can't wait to bring you episode 7 in about a month's time. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you for engaging, and we'll speak to you again soon. Take care.